May it please the court. As I introduced earlier, my name is David Zavon. I introduced my partner, Rachel Roman. Ms. Rachel Roman, earlier I neglected to introduce our co-counsel, Mr. Tommy Harsley, who's here with us as well. So I'm unsure whether this court is familiar with the case law on co-employee liability. I'd like to go through each case in exhaustive detail. To get to our particular case, we know that Mr. McComb was sent out that particular day when there was a bad storm going on. And as I listened to the discussions and the questions from you today, that sounds more like the method of the job that we sent him out that day. Perhaps the policy does or doesn't apply to that day. But then we have this affirmative act similar to the Marshall case where Mr. Norfis decides to call McComb, and the reason he picks up the phone, we can deduce, is because he knows the weather's back. We know that things have changed. We now have a transitory issue going on with respect to him being out on the road. And we call him and say, are you okay? Are you safe? And he says, apparently says, no, I'm not. I'm concerned about driving. So what does Norfis do? He then calls Cheese, who's his supervisor, and says, I think we need to bring him off the road. It's not safe. And Cheese says, no. We then go some more time with the weather getting worse. The next phone call is my windshield wipers are, and the windshield's icing up. I'm going to call Cheese. Cheese, I think we need to get him off the road. No. Let him finish his route. Sending him out that day may or may not be the method. Whether we were at trial, would we submit on the negligent act of sending him out that day? I'm somewhat dubitant as to whether we would even submit on that at trial, because I'm not sure that would survive the motion for summary judgment with respect to co-employee liability. But once we take the affirmative act of calling him, because now we're worried about him, and I don't think any policies do or don't apply to this circumstance. We're similar to the Marshall case where we're actually taking an affirmative act, and we now know that this is an unsafe workplace. We now know that it's danger. It's not about training. It's not about providing him with a safe equipment. That would have to do with if we sent him out there without winter tires, all right, or if we sent him out there with bad wipers. That might come under the list of the five duties of the employer. We don't fall.
Is opposing counsel saying that it was part of the scope of the policy to send people out in bad weather, and so this was just carrying out the employer's policy? I know you say it was a job description. Is that right?
It's as you saw from the Western District, the issue of whether the policies do or don't apply has never been fully developed in this case. And what his job duties were with respect to the inclement weather policy in this circumstance, I don't know that we focused on that, because once we have this affirmative act, I don't know that the policies are going to address what we're doing when we call.
You're not saying you have to have an affirmative act, but that you in fact had one.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I would say under the different versions of where we've seen the definition of co-employee liability, I wonder if this case might not survive even our current definition of co-employee liability, because this is close to being a reckless, purposeful act by Cheese. He's being called by another employee saying, I think we need to get him off the road, and says no. So Cheese says, I never looked out the window, and I never even bothered to see what our policy was. This one is different by way of the...
Do you ever submit the issue of duty to the jury? It sounded like the Western District said the extent of a duty is a jury question, or is causation and negligence a jury question, but duty is for the court?
Duty seems to be with the court based on the case law that I've been been reading, the legal duty of as defined in the cases that we've looked at.
Do we ever submit duty to a jury, or is that always a legal question?
It seems to be negligence and causation that duty would lie with the court. I can't think of a way that we would submit it that way, Your Honor.
What's the significance that Norfus and Cheese are supervisors?
I don't know that they're acting within a supervisory capacity now. We are. Supervisor's responsibility, in my mind, would be let's make sure we have winter tires on the car. That comes within the purview of that job title. Now we're doing something else where we're directing him to stay out on the road in a dangerous condition. I can think of many analogies where we're now have a purposeful act, and I don't know that it matters whether it's a co-employee or a supervisor in my mind, because we're actually directing him to do something dangerous. So I don't think the supervisor gets coverage from that if they are acting just as a supervisor. So in my mind, they've stepped out of that role. Now, in McComb's mind, we can assume that he's thinking, I don't want to lose my job. These are my supervisors. I'm going to stay out on the road. I'm being told to stay out on the road. If I don't stay out on the road, I wonder what the repercussions are going to be. So to answer your question, hopefully I have. I'm not sure whether the supervisory status matters with what.
Well, he wouldn't have followed them unless they were his supervisors. He followed them because they were. So were they carrying out the employer's non-delegable duty to provide a safe workplace, or were they doing an independent act or frolic? Did they create a transitory increased risk?
They're creating the transitory risk because we now know that we're calling him because we're concerned about whether this is an unsafe place. I mean, I don't know about the road.
Does it matter why they did this? If he told them to stay out because he thought the employer's policy was that you stay out no matter the weather? Is that then within the scope of carrying out the employer's non-delegable duty?
No, we don't think that policy would apply regardless, because it talks about employees who are critical employees or working with stat issues. So it's akin to the bad weather coming in and the house officer has to say, you know, bad weather's coming in, we better make sure we have a neurosurgeon close by. So we're going to implement this bad weather policy. So make sure we have this neurosurgeon. She's going to stay in the hospital or a hotel right next to the hospital for a couple days. That's what that policy appears to suggest. Now, again, that hasn't been fully developed. So I don't think they're talking about that policy, but nor is our client, presumably, nor is Mr. McComb following any particular procedure.
Your allegation of negligence, or what you would say you should submit, is that they directed him to stay out on the road even though the employer's policy did not call for that.
Correct.
Okay.
But did they still have a responsibility? I mean, clearly they may have violated that responsibility if you were able to prove those facts. So as the employer acts through the employer's employees who have the responsibility to do all of those non-delegable duties. And so it seems as though these are employees who had a responsibility to do the non-delegable duties. They just didn't do them correctly.
Fair, but I don't. I'm puzzled as to how the non-delegable duty. But I mean, I understand that with respect to sending him out initially. Okay, that seems to fall within, you know, that what you're talking about, that we. That tends to be something that has more to do with the method than the details. The details are that we then changed things by saying, I want to get him off the road, and she says no.
Well, I guess my question is, is it a difference between that those were the responsibilities of those supervisors to provide safe manner of doing the work, and that your argument to us is if they only breached it a little bit, they might be within the non-delegable duty. But if they have some gross breach of the employer's non-delegable duty, somehow that makes it actionable.
Well, I think that's a jury question, certainly, to me, to the way.
If it's all
well,
the employer's.
Isn't that what's wrong with the Western District opinion in this case? It made the duty question a jury question.
I understand that. I understand that probably to be the reason this was accepted here. But I cannot say and stand before you that I think the duty question is the duty is the jury question. That's right. The legal question, most likely. But then when we bring the facts in, like we do on Parr or Marshall or the others, we now change and we're talking about the details as opposed to sending him out there that day to begin with, which again likely would be more of the method of the job that has more to do with the potential policy or inclement weather policy or make sure he's operating this instrument, this vehicle safely, that it has all the equipment it needs. The affirmative act of telling him don't come off the road, I don't see how that, especially in light of the fact that Norfis is getting it right. He knows the guy needs to come off the road. He's calling his supervisor because he's looking out the window. So again, this is I've heard the term rogue. I mean, Cheese is not listening to Norfis, and he's not listening to, frankly, he's not listening to Mr. McCollum either. So it's that affirmative act outside of the position of a supervisory capacity to make this decision to expose this person to danger.
Does it matter what created the lack of safety, whether it was in many of the cases, you know, carrying the stone on the forklift allegedly in an unsafe manner or opening the switch and telling someone you had de-electrified it, but here it was the weather that made it dangerous, or was it something else that the employer did?
Well, we talk about whether, is the work environment kept in a safe manner, is what I've seen in the case law. Is it kept in a safe manner? We don't have any control over the weather or being out on the road, so we can't really keep it in a safe manner. So I don't...
And does that make a difference in terms of liability, that it didn't arise out of the employer failing to keep it in a safe manner, but rather directing you to stay in an unsafe situation? But is that a policy or is that a detail of the work?
It's a detail. The policy is, again, when we get to the policies, I think what we'd see if we were developed this further is he's not someone who's required to be out on the road that day. He's not got an integral job like that neurosurgeon who we have to have at the hospital. He doesn't fit under that. So there's no policy to keep him out on the road that day.
Thank you.
Thanks. May it please the court. My name is Ronald Willenbrock, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents, David Cheese and Mr. Norfis. I have to admit that when Parr and Peters came down, and my case was pending, you had granted cert, and your order to the Western District was, okay, decide this case all over again in light of those two cases, I'm thinking, okay. And when I got Judge Mitchell's second opinion, I'm thinking to myself, where did I go wrong? This case, the facts are so similar to Parr, that it's scary. In the Parr case, the co-employees supervisor were sued because they should have kept him off the road because his health problems were such that he was a It was not a safe workplace for him to be in his condition. There's no, you just take the names and submit them or change them around a little bit and put in, well, they left Mr. McComb out on the road because the weather conditions were bad. And I'm thinking, well, when the Western District takes a look at the Parr case, they're going to understand. And then I saw in the opinion that, well, the Parr case doesn't apply according to the Western District because that really was decided on pleading issues. The case wasn't pleaded properly is what I think was stated in the footnote. And I went back and I read over the Parr case again. And I saw that there was comments made in the opinion by you, Justice Breckinridge, that the federal regulation that they say was violated in Parr could have constituted, at least the plaintiffs were contending, negligence per se. And you said that wasn't pleaded. But you went on, the court in its opinion went on to state that, well, that really didn't make any difference. So that's the only thing I could find in there that the issue was based upon pleading.
There clearly is a difference here than the facts of Parr, and that is that here the employer knew what the circumstances were, knew what the dangers were. They're not like someone having a health condition that may or may not be a problem. And here the supervisors directed him to be in a circumstance that was dangerous.
If, and I'll take that as true, the differences you're raising there right now, I'll get into what I think there's a little different, there are supervisors.
Well,
okay, and so being that's...
That'll be my next question. my next question is, they don't appear to be the supervisors that set the policy.
That's correct.
And so they themselves are violating the policy for a safe workplace. So it's not like they are the ones who are undertaking to create the safe workplace. You know, are they acting in a supervisory role for a safe workplace when they violate the employer's policy?
All right, now, I've got a quarrel with the court's use of the employer's policy. There was no weather policy. My opponent and I advised the Western District Court in our first oral argument that there was none and that was not the issue. They've taken the job description now and turned that into the policy, and I sincerely object to that as not being the facts.
Well, if there was no policy, doesn't that aid the plaintiff in that there was no policy? They were simply carrying out saying, hey, policy requires you to stay on the road. They simply chose to say, and we know it's unsafe, but keep driving. So isn't that make it more of a transitory risk?
No, they're doing it as a supervisor.
But supervisors can be negligent too. You're saying as a matter of law, no supervisor can be negligent?
Supervisors can be negligent, but when they are, clearly that's within the employer's non-delegable duty to provide a safe
workplace.
They have to have supervisors that, quote, don't become negligent. I don't consider.
So you are saying a supervisor can never have an independent duty. If they told him to drive off a cliff, that would not be a violation.
No and yes. Okay. I don't want to.
Not an intentional tort, of course.
I understand that, Your Honor. In this particular instance, what we're talking about is decisions made as supervisors that keep the man out on the road. Okay, the bad conditions. He's driven in bad conditions before. So whether or not they should have brought him in or not is really not the question. Let me go back and try to answer it this way. I got all over Carl Gartner in Benami versus Gartner when he wrote this. Something more came down from the court. Can there be something more with a co-employee? Not supervisor. And I said to Carl, I said, good Lord, what we're looking at here is the first test that should be done is does the pleading state a cause of action under our common law? Disregard the title co-employee. All of the cases that get so muddled that, like, maybe that's creating somehow another duty because you're a co-employee. Well, it doesn't. And so, could my people be sued as individuals because they didn't tell them to get off the road? Oh, but they're a co-employee. And that's, if they're supervisors, they're immune. If they're not supervisors and they're co-employees, then can they be sued? What about the receptionist that took the call from Mr. McComb and he's explaining to her about, you know, the weather's bad out here. She's a co-employee. Can she be sued by not making him come off the road? No. Well, I equate that.
You're saying if an unrelated person had said, no, stay on the road, keep driving, you could not sue them for it because they had no duty to tell you in what conditions you could drive or not. The duty only arose because of their position as a supervisor, and therefore it was in the within the non-delegable duty.
That's my position is just that, Your Honor. Okay. Now, in any event, and then after reading Judge Wilson's concurring opinion in Parr, and then I went back and read the other, and he was a little disturbed about these issues becoming really interwoven. And I thought to myself, you know, if an employer provides a punch press and it breaks while an employee is using it and injures them, clearly that's prepared to provide a safe workplace. Now let's add the issue that, well, the foreman supervisor has a job of making sure that the equipment is in proper working order, but it broke. So therefore he had to have violated duty. He didn't check it, but there's no evidence other than that. There would be no cause of action against that supervisor. Now, I'm a co-employee working on a punch press that shoots things out, and another employee standing down the way shoots it out and hits him. I'm not a supervisor, I'm a co-employee. Would I have a right to be sued because this machine kicked it out, unfortunately, and sent it over to him? I'm certain the answer is I'm not under common law as I understand it. So when we looking at what test should be applied here, so in my opinion, the very first thing that, like Judge Beadham looked at is, oh, wait a minute, disregard that they're co-employees. Could Mr. McComb sue Mr. Narfus? Could Mr. McComb sue Mr. Cheese because they kept him out on the road? Forget that they're co-employees. No, he could not under common law. So right then and there, the petition fails. Then we go to the next step. Well, but okay, they're supervisors. We got to have a jury trial to determine first for the jury trial, the jury to determine, are they really acting within the scope and course of their employment as supervisors? And was that a violation of the employer's duty to make sure they were trained? And that's why I think Leaker, I know portions of it were overruled, but the whole case should have been overruled on it. It really creates a problem for us out there and pets out there trying to figure out what are we really doing when we're looking at that. Luckily, 2012's gone, the time for these things now. There's not going to be many more of these cases that we have to worry about. So when I got the docket and I looked at the cases, what I normally do is I go through each case, see what they're all about. First time in my 50 years before an appellate court of any nature that they were all the same issue. And I'm thinking to myself, well, let's take a look at these cases. Okay, well, boy, it's all over. What would I do? And I decided that is not my job, so I'm not going to get into that. Now, I went on to the carpet weather policy, and there was none. It's within the job description that he's to stay out on the road. But clearly a supervisor could have brought him off. I'm not denying that.
Can a supervisor create a transitory risk?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Can a supervisor create a transitory risk?
Not acting as a supervisor, no. Not in my opinion. Because I think this, when you look at the common law not the common law, but the statutory prohibitions that the employer must provide a non-delegable duty to provide a safe workplace. What's the difference between an employee who errs and goofs up and injures another employee as opposed to the employer's workplace where the floor was wet and slipped and fell on it? So and Judge Wilson's comments in part got me thinking, can there be a violation of the non, can there be anything that violates the duty, the non-delegable duty of the employer? A negligent employee is no different than a machine that breaks down, unless it's intentional. I'm not getting to that standpoint. I mean, that's just part of the workplace.
Well, that's arguably what Taylor v. Wallace said, but is that case still valid in light of what we said in Peterson Park?
No. And I was just wondering if
and
dubious comments that the fact that Judge Wilson was dubious about whether that was getting into that or not. I'm not saying, well, I'm just saying that's what got me to be.
Can you address, you said a supervisor cannot create a transitory risk, but what if the supervisor, knowing the employer's policy, purposefully chooses to direct the employees to act in a way contrary to the policy?
I would like to take the position you judges take that we don't answer hypothetical questions. Something to that, Your Honor. It is possible, I guess. In my world, I don't think so. I mean, the supervisor violates, he's the supervisor. Let's take the supervisor away. It's a owner of the company, a sole proprietorship, making a decision with another employee. He's clearly doing it as the employer to provide a safe place to work, and he made it wrong. So how can we change? The supervisor is nothing more than, quote, as if the owner doing the company.
Thank you, counsel.
Oh, I see. I've got, there's one more thing I wanted to add here, and this is going to open up a can of worms. I should have probably taken my mouth shut on, but as pointed out by my opponents, the plaintiff in this action, the appellant, is deceased, and on the 15th of February, filed suggestions and a motion for substitution with Judge Beacom down in Cole County, which you've got a case from this court on his case that he had no jurisdiction to do anything on it. If you look at the case of State of Missouri et al. Versus Reese, and you look at the statutes, does this court have jurisdiction now since there's been no substitution of parties? And the rule wasn't followed that a motion, it says that notice pursuant to 4301 is filed at the same time, and that wasn't done. Does that mean that, as the court decided in Reese, that we don't have any authority, cases dismissed? I hate to bring up that can of worms, and your first question to me is, Mr. Warnberg, why didn't you put that out in your brief? I couldn't put it into my brief at the time because he still had the time after our brief was filed in which to file the notice and decide whether or not to ask the court to have it sent back down.
Does our rule provide what will happen if such notice is not timely provided? Does it say we lose jurisdiction?
I'm sorry, one more time.
Does our rule say what happens if timely notice is not provided? Does it give a consequence?
It does, and I think that's what the Reese case covers when it was about. It really was about the difference between the Supreme Court rule and the statute.
Okay.
And what comes.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
If we could use the Peters case as an example, hypothetical is, remember that we have these dowel baskets that are poorly stacked on the back of this truck. Let's just say that Norfus is there looking at it, and he sees this stack starting to fall, and he sees that the cone's underneath it. And he sees that he might get hurt, and he calls Cheese and says, hey, I see these things are about to fall on McComb. Should I get him out of the way? No. It doesn't matter if we're the supervisor or not, or a co-employee. This is the affirmative act that changes the dynamics of who they are and what their act is, which is outside of any safety policy. Does Norfolk look at that situation and say, you know, if I say something, it's an affirmative act, but if I stay back and watch it, well, I have immunity, and I am not going to have to be responsible. I have no duty to act. That's what I think we're trying to create here, is to tell supervisors or co-employees, you know, don't act if you see an employee in danger. And that would be chilling. So I think the other issue I wanted to address is this policy. We don't see a policy that frankly applies to this case that we can see yet. It still has to be developed. But his job duties are to go out, and sometimes he has to be in inclement weather because he's picking up these supplies. That doesn't mean he has to drive in a snowstorm or an ice storm. It doesn't mean he has to stay out on the road, and that's our policy. Furthermore, the policy about inclement weather is not implemented by Norfolk or Cheese. In fact, they have they aren't the ones who implement the policy. They don't have that power. There's a house officer, house administrator, whose job it is to say, let's implement the inclement weather policy. And that doesn't apply. That only applies to those employees who are critical to the safety of the hospital and the patients. Again, McCone's doesn't fit within the description of the people that should be called in an emergency in inclement weather. So for those reasons, the policies probably don't apply when we get to trial, but more has to be done to assure that. But it doesn't look to the plaintiffs like that would be our issue. It has more to do with this affirmative act while they're out there and not getting him out of the way of the falling dowel baskets. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.